What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back, everybody, to Dante's Divine Comedy Podcast. And today we are very happy to present one of our great inspirations when it comes to understanding philosophy, theology, and also opening more of the worlds of Dante. And this is then Dr. Philip Carey, and he's a professor of philosophy at Eastern University in St. David's, Pennsylvania. He's also a PhD in philosophy in religious studies from Yale University. He has taught at Yale University, University of Connecticut, and University of Hartford. He's written several books, and his speciality is the thought of Augustine, but he has also published scholarly articles on Luther, the doctrine of the Trinity, and personal knowledge. And especially for us is the series of From the Great Courses, which was a huge opener for us. So welcome, Dr. Phil Carey.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So we're going to talk today about Dante's Paradiso, the structure of Dante's cosmology, and then perhaps a little bit about the sun, the fourth sphere. So we're going to start on something you mentioned in an email, which is to talk about the architecture of the cosmos, then starting with the Paradiso and why the movements are in circles and every movement is already perfect. And why, especially this one, why circular movement is the perfected form of movement in mind as well as space. So you can start now to kind of frame the whole big topic of the cosmology of and structure.
Right. So it's interesting to start at the end, right? So instead of starting with hell, the way the reading experience starts, let's start with Paradiso, with paradise and heaven. Because in fact, we are not used to thinking about heaven. We have this notion called outer space, which is entirely foreign to the way Dante thinks. And what it means is we really don't think about heaven in the classical sense. When Dante looks up at the stars, he sees heaven, and that's where we go when we die, if we're good people, right? Well, why? First of all, what we see is circular movement, according to the astronomy that goes back to Plato and Ptolemy and so on. Useful to know, the ancient Greeks, they knew that the world was a sphere. They knew that the world was spherical. It wasn't Columbus who discovered that the world was round. No, Plato already knew that. Circular movement was perfect movement because it's not a journey. A journey is imperfect so long as it's still going on, right? And imperfect, by the way, simply means incomplete. One of the most important things to get is that the word perfect is Latin for complete. So a journey is always incomplete as long as it's still going on. It's not perfect. Any journey that's still taking place is not perfect because it hasn't reached its goal. So what could perfect movement be like? Movement complete at every moment. Well, think of a dance, right? In a dance, you're not trying to get to the end the way you are at a journey, right? So you're circling. Dances are constantly circles, right? And the image of the dance occurs several times in the Paradiso. Why? Because every moment of the movement is already complete and perfect and satisfying and delightful and joyful, like a dance. You're not trying to get to the end of it, but you are moving. So the circular movement is a combination of rest and movement in one, right? It's rest in the sense that it's come to its goal. It's come to its completion, right? It's not trying to get somewhere else. Whereas in purgatory, we are on a journey. We're trying to get somewhere else. In heaven, we've already arrived. So every movement has got to be arrival at every moment, right? And then to go all the way back to the beginning then, hell is where people are stuck. And the deepest image for that at the very bottom is the people stuck in ice, right? Who cannot move. But even at the higher levels of hell, where things are not quite so bad, think of the lustful. They're being blown about, right? And that's also a way of being stuck, right? They can't move themselves. They're not on a journey, but they're also not dancing. They're just being battered about, and aimless movement is another way of being stuck. So those are the three fundamental forms of movement. Either you're stuck in hell, or you're on a journey in purgatory, or you're dancing in heaven. Those are the three kinds of movements. And so it's useful to start with the dance, because that's where we're destined to be if we arrive at our goal.
Yeah. It's so interesting also how, if it ties into the overall movement of the whole comedy, with like, it starts with Virgin Mary, who sees the pilgrim lost in the forest, and it goes all the way until the final canto, when Bernard kind of gives the prayer to Mary, and then the whole kind of from the grace and all the way, like there's a certain circle of the whole comedy.
Right. There's a huge circle in the whole composition, right? Because there's no way that Dante can ascend without the first a descent, right? And so when Virgil meets him and says, you're going to have to take this trip with me to go through to first through hell and then purgatory, Dante is afraid, right? He can't do it. And there's a theology here behind this of nature and grace, right? By nature, we are not, our bodies don't go to heaven by nature. The heaven is for light. It's not for earthly bodies. And then, of course, our bodies are corrupted by sin. So Dante is not ready for this trip. So in order for him to descend and then ascend and then get all the way to heaven, heaven first must descend. And that's why in the second canto, I believe it is, there's this story, which you just referred to. It begins with Mary, and she speaks to Lucia, who's a feminine figure of grace and light. Lucia, of course, means light. And then Lucia speaks to Beatrice. And Beatrice, of course, is going to be Dante's guide in Paradiso. So there's the descent, because Mary, of course, is the highest human being there is other than Christ incarnate. And so there's this descent of a message from Mary to Lucia down to Beatrice. And then Beatrice, God bless her, she goes all the way down to hell to talk to Virgil, right? This is extraordinary. It's like light coming from heaven, which oddly enough is not exactly natural. Right, because and this is crucial to the way everything moves in the whole Divine Comedy. Light goes up. Have you ever seen flames that burn down? No, flames go up because it's going up to heaven, where its home is among the light of the stars and the sun. And Earth goes down because Earth is heavy. There's four elements in medieval physics, and you know, Earth goes down, fire goes up. Water and air are in the middle. If you think of a lake on a sunny day, you'll see it, right? The sun is up high, then there's the air, then there's the lake, and then there's the water at the bottom. So it's natural for Earth to fall down, right? And for all these heavy things to collect at the bottom of the world and crush Satan, who's at the center of the physical universe. But going up, that's not so natural to us. And it can't happen unless what is heavenly first descends. And so the heavenly light is a constant image of grace. The descent of the light in its gracefulness, rather than, you know, the light could have just stayed up in heaven and left us alone. But instead, it comes and makes our ascent possible. So one of you wanted to mention a favorite moments, right? One of my very favorite moments in the whole poem is there in that second canto, and Dante's afraid, but he hears the story from Virgil about how grace and help and mercy has come from Mary to Lucia to Beatrice to Virgil. And when he hears this story, he says he's like a flower on a cold, cold night, which is all closed up, right? And you might think that as he's preparing to take a trip to hell, he'd have an image of being closed up in armor. But instead, it's the light of heaven that warms the flower so that it opens up to the light above. And that's what makes it possible for him to go into hell. Not closing up in armor, but opening up to the light above. That's what grace feels like.
Right? It's such a beautiful moment. I prepared two things to read, and that was one of them. When he says that the three such gracious ladies who are blessed, watch out for you up there in heaven's court, and my words too bring promise of such good. This is then Virgil speaking. And then the pilgrim says, as little flowers from the frosty night are closed and limp, and when the sun shines down on them, they rise to open on their stem. My wilted strength began to bloom within me, and such warm courage flowed into my heart that I spoke like a person set free of fear.
Yeah.
And it struck me so, there's so much what you said now, but when you talked about that Dante has to go down, what gripped me first, like 15 years ago with the comedy, was this emotional connection to the work, his fear in the first canto, the loss of hope in as they go into the worst part of Inferno is that you lose your hope. It's not the pain. It just struck me as so deeply psychologically, kind of the insight was so profound. Yeah. And also this little scene that he's this image, because that's how big things can start in you as this fragile little flower, and then it can grow into something very strong eventually. And other things you said there, it's this thing that like to ascend. We don't really get the explanation until paradise when they start flying, and then the pilgrim is confused and Beatrice is explaining, we are now in heaven. This is as natural as a stream of water falls down the mountainside, right, that we are now going upwards instead. So,
because grace has a nature of its own, and that nature of grace is to ascend. Right. So our soul, when it is enlightened by grace, ascends. Right. And there's images, of course, of the light that kindles the will. Right. The image of light and fire go together, and the light warms you, and, you know, warm things go up. Right. And it kindles you, and it's fire. And one of the things to be aware of as we think through this is that fire for Dante is a heavenly image. Right, because it's warm, it's light. There's an old image used by many of the church fathers. It's in Origen, it's in Augustine, it's in Thomas, of an iron bar that is incandescent from the heat and the light. Right, imagine a blacksmith shop with an incandescent iron bar. Now, iron is made of earth. It's cold. It's heavy. It doesn't ascend to heaven, but fire. Right, we become like an iron bar, incandescent with the fiery love of God. Right, because fire is an image for the love of God. It lifts us up. It heads towards heaven where it belongs, and so it's as natural for the iron bar to go upward as it is for fire to go upward, if it's incandescent with the light and fire of the love of God.
It really comes towards the end of Paradiso then with both the seraphims, which then means fire in Hebrew, and Empyrean, which also means on fire, as the mind of the divine and the final destination. Yes. So it's that imagery. And I've seen it explained more and more that, like, why the deepest of Inferno is not burning, that it is. It's more about the lack of freedom with sin and the mistakes that it will it will take control of you, and then you will be unable to have any freedom at all.
No freedom at all. Right. So when Dante goes into hell, you are alluding to, of course, to that terrifying gate, right? Abandon all hope, ye who enter
yes,
here.
Yes, exactly.
So he walks in, and then one of the first images is of the starless air, right? The air without the light of heaven.
It's a strong image.
It's a powerful image. And again, if you think of the four elements, what he's saying is, in hell, you're going to have earth, you're going to have water, you're going to have air, but you won't have the light of heaven. You won't have fire, right? So there's some things that burn and so on, but no heavenly light. And so the deeper you get, the colder it gets. You're getting as far away from the light and warmth of heaven as possible. And at the bottom of it all, you're stuck in ice, right? You've got water that behaves like earth because it's so cold. Right, no light, no heat, no warmth, no nothing. Yeah. Whereas when you get up into paradise, one of the things we have to get used to in the medieval cosmology, when you get to the heavens, there's no earth up there, right? There are no planets with dirt, right? We have this notion that there are planets and they have earth, like Mars has dirt in it. Not for Dante, it doesn't, right? These things are spheres of light. And if they're made out of anything, the spheres are made out of a fifth element, right? But there is no dirt in heaven. Come on, heaven is where earth is not. Earth is down, heaven is up. And what happened, I mean, only of like two or three centuries after Dante, here comes Galileo with this notion that the rules of motion are the same in heaven as on earth. And not in Dante, they're not, right? Motion works differently in heaven than on earth because heaven is heaven, for heaven's sakes, right?
It's still a kind of a radical claim, though, to say that the laws of physics and nature that we experience here necessarily applies to the whole of the cosmos. It's not a given.
It's so, not a given at all. It was a brilliant achievement of Galileo's science. Alas, Galileo was right about the physical universe. So we have to imagine our way back to a different physics that we no longer believe in. But it renders and makes visible the movements of the heart and the soul and the spirit. And that's what's so powerful about Dante. Every physical movement in Dante's poem is an image of a spiritual movement. Every single one. Right?
Yeah. There's no. I was about to say that there's a certain kind of a spiritual geography to when, especially as they leave the top of Mount Purgatory. Well, it changes all the way from, I would say, from the fifth terrace when you have this earthquake, which is not an earthquake, but it's the release on purgatory as a as a spiritual release when you really get the material and spiritual kind of disconnecting with the statues that he becomes ready to ascend. From there on, you have this kind of two levels at least to the whole storytelling, that it becomes an abstract spiritual world to orient yourself in. So.
The whole picture is a picture of how the will moves the soul, the way physical energy moves the body. And you might think that these folks in purgatory are being kept against their will, but not at all. They're there because their will says, I need to be purified. And as soon as their will says, as soon as their intellect recognizes that they're purified, the will says, okay, I can go. Let's go. Climb. Time to climb. Yeah. And one of the wonderful things about the whole law of ascent in purgatory is the higher you get, the lighter you are.
Yes.
The climb gets easier as you go.
It's so beautiful. Yeah. When the pilgrim is complaining at the first, like when they start, because it goes straight up and you need both your hands and your feet. And then Virgil just gives him some support and says, yeah, it's as opposed to normal mountains, this is hardest at the beginning, but then eventually it will, climbing up will be like floating downstream in a little boat,
right? That's that image from the four elements, right? Water flows down, earth falls down, fire goes up, right? And that's why so much of the imagery in Paradiso is fire and light and translucency and so on.
Yeah, I also really like when the two concepts you mentioned now with the will and also aiming, because they are so fundamental to understanding, in some sense, the practical side of the comedy and how it can help you in your world life and the world for you now. I think especially the will is one of those things that takes the longest to understand, that it's about your freedom of choice and that you can choose in life we are given the freedom to choose in life, and then your choices then have consequences. So you can be on the side, but like there's no judgment really in Inferno and Paradiso. It's more the consequence of your your choices. But then the big challenge, like Dante is suggesting many in many places, is that aiming is really hard. Like finding the right thing is like, it's a bit like archery, that you actually have to find that little point that you should aim at. It's so easy to go wrong. So if you have any thoughts about that.
Well, there's a magnificent thing that Aristotle says, which is in the background here, when he says, getting things right is hard because, you know, it's hard to hit the target. It's easy to miss it.
Exactly.
Right. Missing the bullseye is the easy thing to do. Right. Hitting it, that's hard. Right.
Yeah.
It takes intelligence and vision and discipline, all of it. Right. But
You might also say guidance. I mean, that's also what Dante wants us to do. He wants to guide us for aiming.
Right. He wants us to see where we're going so that we can aim more properly. Right. Because intellect and will go together, right? Those are the two fundamental features of the movement, right? The will is what moves you with love and desire, but the intellect is what sees where you're going. And so the will without the intellect is just aimless. It's like being blown about with the lustful, right? So you got to have the intellect as well. You got to have light, which is why in Purgatorio, you can't climb except during the daytime. You have to have the heavenly light descending in order for you to ascend, right? And then you were talking about how the physical and the spiritual are connected and disconnected. There's a wonderful moment near the top of the Paradiso, which I don't want to neglect, where Dante sees everything turned inside out, right? Because in the physical world, Satan is literally at the center of the physical world, right? He's down at the bottom, and it's at the center of the universe because all of the weight of sin and earthly desire, crushes him, right? Because sin is a kind of earthly love. My love is my weight, says Augustine in a famous passage, right? But that means fire has a weight that drives you upward, right? In ancient physics, fire pushes you upward. Earth puts you downward. If you have earthly desires, it's all going to crush you, just like Satan at the center of the universe. But that's the physical universe. The spiritual universe has, of course, God at the center. And it turns inside out, and all of a sudden, God is at the center, and then you have these, instead of the spheres of the physical heavens, you have the spheres of the celestial hierarchy. And you have all the angels, with the seraphim being at the closest, right? Because they're the ones who are really on fire, right? And the further ones away are moving more slowly because they're further from the heat of the love of God at the center of things. So the spiritual world looks like the physical world turned inside out.
Yeah, that moment is one of the most mind-bending things to read, because you get to the fixed stars, the constellations, you go into the first mover as this outer shell that sets. I mean, in some sense, it's the bottom of the Aristotelian metaphysics, or like his idea of divinity as well. Like, and then suddenly he moves, he looks deep into the motion, and then suddenly he starts seeing this point of divine light and circles. But then what has embedded the whole material cosmos suddenly inverts, like you said there, and it becomes the center. And then, because that's the center of time and being, it just kind of emanates out into all directions. It's just, there's a kind of beauty of literature that you have this temporal element that you can actually use words and make this transition in the mind when you read it, but it's still, it's almost like a mystery how he could come up with the image.
It's stunning how he manages to do the poetry. And then he keeps saying, but I can't really describe, but it's way beyond my power to describe. Let me tell you the next thing, which is even more beyond my power to describe, right? Because one of the things that happens as he's ascending is he keeps being dazzled, right? That image of the light was too bright for me, which is a way of saying my intellect couldn't grasp this because it was too intelligible, too beautiful for the intellect. And then he goes on because precisely by being dazzled at this level, he's ready to be strengthened for seeing at the next level. And this happens beginning in the Purgatorio and throughout the Paradiso. He keeps the eyes of his mind, right? The eye of the mind keeps getting stronger and stronger.
Exactly.
Precisely as it's dazzled by what is too much for it.
It's a wonderful dynamic. Yeah, it's such a beautiful process that he can take in more and more of the light. Like if you stare into the center of theology, it's too much for you in the beginning. So you got to take the steps. You got to grow with it. Take a bit of time. And there's this one moment when Beatrice, I think it's right after the great-great-grandfather, when he looks at her, and then she suddenly, like, he wants to look at her eyes to see more of the paradise. And suddenly she says, like, can't you see now? Paradise is everywhere now.
Yeah.
It's not just in my eyes. You don't have to focus into theology anymore. It's becoming part of your whole world, your whole being, everywhere. And it's such a beautiful little...
Yes, because one of the things that's happening as you ascend is you can look down, and there's a moment when he looks back and he sees the whole darn thing. Well, not the whole darn, it's a beautiful thing, right? But it's also tiny, right? Earth is so small by comparison to heaven.
That's one of my favorites from the first time I read it. But like, it looks so paltry. He looks down the spheres and looks at the little earth. It's just like, it's so small.
And it used to take up so much of my imagination, right? Yeah. I mean, it's the first two canticles of the Divine Comedy. I've struggled with that stuff. But now look at how tiny it is.
Yeah.
That couldn't hold me back. How could that possibly have held me back, right? Let me look up again, right? And then he looks through the fixed stars where he first sees Christ and Mary, and to the prima mobile, which is the outermost sphere, which moves most fast and moves the other spheres. And then for those people who are not familiar with this ancient astronomy and the medieval view, right, the out beyond the outermost sphere is, as you say, it's called the Empyrean, right? The heaven of fire is what it means in Greek. And it's that doesn't move, right? It's the perfection of peace, the space outside of space in which the movement of space is contained. Dante is trying to give us an image of space outside of space, because inside space everything's moving, right? All those spheres are moving, but outside space it's just the purity of the fire of God's love. But you can't take that too literally, because of course there can't really be a space outside of space. That's so what you do is you look at it, and as you're looking at it carefully, boom, the inversion happens, and it suddenly this thing that's outside of space becomes the center. Right. Yeah. Because Dante knows that you can't really just picture God as sort of outside space, as if you could just climb up there. Right. No, he's at the center. But physically, he's outside. But, you know, spiritually, he's at the center.
As a tiny aside to that, it's like this idea of immaterial reality beyond time and space. This might be a little bit kind of quirky for some listeners, but some of the Greeks started with the idea of numbers. Like, numbers exist. Yeah. Outside of time and space, they don't have an age. They are nowhere. Where is number five as a concept? It's like, it's everywhere. It's nowhere. It's like, and it's there's a one little example. I know this is an old Greek trick, isn't it? Like, to just open up the thinking we can apprehend something beyond time and space, something immaterial, which is a reality.
Which is a reality. Yeah. In fact, this is fascinating because I mentioned Augustine, who had that wonderful line about "My love is my weight." And that's an image for movement within time and space. But Augustine was also deeply fascinated with the omnipresence of God. Right? God is present everywhere, but not spread out like a material thing, like water in a sponge or fire in the universe, for that matter. Right? God is present everywhere as a whole, because the image of the center is like the center point of a geometrical figure. Right? It has no inner structure. It's perfectly simple, right? It has no parts. And therefore, wherever God is present, God is always present as a whole, because God doesn't have parts, right? And so that omnipresence as a whole is the secret that means that God is, you know, not in space, because he's present everywhere. Precisely because he's not in space, he's wholly present everywhere in space. Yeah.
So I still have the sense that this is what Dante is trying to get at, that this mystery in the moon, like as a portal into paradise, when he's sucked into the moon, like light into water, and then he's a solid body. The moon is supposed to be a solid body. It's not supposed to work, but it does. And it's he's hinting, like, if you can start apprehending this, like, there's a truth here that will sparkle or shine like a star or like a gem. So there's something about like, again, the spiritual material being united. It's not, it's right. About this, you need a different way of thinking that they exist. They're not directly connected, but they are united. But like, it's a right. It's a mind bender, all of this. But you do, the more you read Paradiso, and this is where it is done when he is explaining that the pilgrim needs time to take in more of the light. You feel the same if you keep reading Paradiso several times, that you gradually understand more and more. Or it's like you're training up some kind of apparatus almost in your brain that you can actually start understanding it. And so
I think that's absolutely right. I have a friend who's reading, I think, Dante seriously for the first time and is finding the Paradiso very abstract.
Yes.
Right. And for the first reading, yeah, okay, it's very abstract. You're not used to thinking this way, but Dante is trying to teach you.
Yes.
That's why that ascent, right?
And that's when you see, like, he's such a kind and gentle teacher in his work. He's, I mean, Purgatory was my favorite for many years, but now Paradiso is starting to become the one I keep going back to because it keeps giving and giving and giving. I just want to say one other thing, like, on the side for listeners with the aiming and like the purgatory, mm-hmm. like, just two words that are really helpful because of penance and this, oh, they have to be punished and God. But like, so, but the idea with repentance is then metanoia in the Greek, is to change your mind, and sin is the archery word for the Greek to miss the mark. It's kind of you're not hitting the right thing. So kind of, you're just supposed to change your mind from making mistakes. That's it's not this authority kind of judging and punishing. It's a very joyful, uplifting, and motivating, inspiring process that he is suggesting.
You're quite right. I mean, it's striking that the word for sin in the Greek New Testament is hamartia, which means missing the mark, which is it's a word for aiming at failing to aim at the bullseye, right? And you can aim at the wrong thing, right? You can aim for adultery instead of marriage. You can aim for cheating and getting filthy rich rather than the richness of divine love. And one of the things that is key here is that both intellect and will are corrupted together, right? You aim at the wrong thing because you see the wrong way, and you see the wrong way because you aim at the wrong thing. So they have to be cleansed, and they have to be cleansed together, right? The mind has to be cleansed at the same time as the will. And then there's that wonderful moment when someone like Statius realizes, okay, I'm totally cleaned off. What should I do? I should do what I want to do, right? Augustine has this lovely moment, love and then do whatever you want. But of course it means love God with your whole heart, mind, and strength, and your neighbor as yourself, and then do what love prompts you to do, which in Statius' case is, let's get up and climb the hill. And, oh, Dante, let me tell you about what love is all about, right?
Yeah.
And,
I mean, it also echoes the idea of the when they're at the top of the Purgatory Mountain, when Virgil has this big speech as a symbol of rationality, like, I have taught you everything I can. Now you're ready to follow the pleasure, follow your desires now, because you have the foundation, the rational foundation, which is crucial to have first before you can start ascending into something transcendent or something mysterious. And
that's a wonderful moment. It's like I crown and mitre you, I think is what he says, right?
Yeah,
so Lord, you're king and bishop, and you should do what you will to do because now your will is pure. And it's hard to imagine being in that place where you should do what you will to do because your will is so pure, but this is something to aspire to, right?
Exactly.
But it's like we are at best at the bottom of purgatory.
And we keep going back to the beach at the beginning, I think, look up at the mountain. Like, it's something you can climb several times. It's so just the idea of the topic of the vices and the virtues is something that I've really learned so much going into the details of what this really is, and then it changes you, and then suddenly you start seeing the world differently. One of the countless practical examples, but one is like this envy, that the root of envy is the misplacement of value. So it comes from putting material values on top, because if you put spiritual values on top, there is no envy. Like, you're not gonna, it's just a mutual reflection of, like, the divine love, as he says, but the goodness will just kind of reinforce itself, because the more there is, the better it is for everybody.
Yeah, there's an image like of that in Paradiso, which I'm sure it's what you're thinking of, right? Where the light hits a mirror, then it hits another mirror. And, and instead of diminishing it, it grows, right?
Yes.
So if I see someone else in paradise who is full of the love of God, that fills me with more love of God. And it just keeps on growing. Yeah. That's one of the crucial messages, you know, early on with Picarda, right? Who's appears in the lowest sphere. And Dante's kind of thinking, what? I mean, aren't you disappointed? And she says, and she kind of laughs in this heavenly way. Like, you know, I was like, don't you understand? Every place here is heaven. And we are in-willed in his will. I mean, the Dante invents new Italian to say this. We are in-willed in his will. And in his will is our peace, that famous, wonderful line. You know, how could I not be happy to be looking at, say, Mary, and she's so much more glorious than I am? Isn't that wonderful? And we're so far from actually being that unenvious, but maybe we can just imagine looking at Mary and saying, isn't it good that she is more holy and glorious than I am? Yeah. Right? Wouldn't it be dreadful if I got to heaven and discovered I was better than Mary? No.
But it is.
I know enough about Christianity, you know, not to think that way, right?
But it is one of those things that is one of the most common things to stumble over in the beginning of Paradiso, and people think this is strange. Why should you be happy at level 1 or 2 when you have 9 or 10 levels? But then, as you say, one thing is all of them live in the Empyrean. They're reflected down into the spheres. So the pilgrim with his small intellect, as Beatrice kind of hints at, can understand it. Like we as readers, we can't understand really what it is. So we need to be presented with an image. But it's also like Picarda says that we have exactly the right amount of blessing according to our capacity for it. So you could think like if you, many things in life, you don't necessarily, the more isn't better always. Like there's something called this is perfect for me and this is what's going to make me most happy. That's right.
I am filled to the brim with the love of God is one of the things she's saying. And the other thing that's important is she's saying, I mean, don't think that any of us in heaven is being punished. There is no punishment in heaven, right? There's different levels of joy, but of course that's appropriate and beautiful, right? You wouldn't want someone like me to be higher up than Mary, would you? Right? I don't want to be higher up than Mary, right? And that cleanses us of that awful envy and that spiritual competitiveness. I mean, when I teach this text, it does offend my students when they first encounter this. It's the first big, you know, a hurdle for understanding the paradise. But you've got to learn that it's a really good thing that there are people who are better than you and closer to God, right? And you can rejoice in that. And when you do, you are lit up more because it's that. You know, the light gets increased as it's mirrored in more mirrors, right? So your own joy increases when you take joy in saying, you know, blessed are you among women, right? More blessed than any woman. Right? Of course, that's going to fill us with more joy, but it's got to be, you know, it's going to be this unenvious joy. Yes.
Yeah. I don't think everyone would be happy in the seraphim level of intensity. I think you could be
right. I'm not ready for that one, that's for sure. It's probably never will be. Yeah.
Ask yourself, where would you be then if you're like level 3, 5, 7?
I want to hang out with the theologians, I think. If I get to the theologians, I'll be happy. Yeah.
The fourth level of the sun, that would be, yeah. I'm just going to have a couple of notes from the, so you wrote a paper about Augustine and Dante, and we touched upon so many of these things already, but there is a couple of things that I really liked. For example, then the ontology of heaven, it's about increasingly aligning oneself through the journey, more and more resemble the will, the resemblance of the will and the soul. But I thought this, back to this will thing for one little moment, about understanding that you have so the will by movement that is not in place, because I read somewhere about like getting closer to the divine, like what does it mean if you don't have space? And then one said or wrote that it's about likeness and resemblance. More resemblance, then you are closer. And I thought this was like mind-blowing to just think in this way.
And that is how Augustine thinks. There's some hints about that in Plato. In the Theaetetus, you know, what does the journey look like? It looks like becoming more like God. Plato himself says that. And of course, Augustine loves that too. And so this is one of the ways in which the classical tradition and the Christian tradition are agreeing about this, right? How does the soul move? Because the soul is not a physical thing, right? The mind especially, right? How many, your brain is like 3 inches wide, but your mind is not 3 inches wide. So it doesn't occupy space. It doesn't move around in space. How does it move? By love and desire and by likeness. As it moves closer to God, it becomes more like God, more full of love, more full of delight and joy. And of course, the imagery of light in the Paradiso is all about that, right? The brighter you are, the more you are like the light of God. And I think that's right. But it's only the beginning of an imagery of you know, what does likeness to God really look like? Yeah. Well, it looks something like the increase of light, but we need to say a lot more.
So it also ties a bit into idea of in some sense, like eternal knowledge. And then, I mean, this is more like a classic or like medieval thought, but like we discover the same wisdom over and over. It's not your personal wisdom. Yeah. So the more you grow, the more you align yourself with the established eternal wisdom. And I have the sense sometimes that this is what Dante is hinting at when he says that we should align our will with the divine will, is that we should understand these timeless dynamics and like the nature of the world and the wisdom, and then we choose to for the good, like we understand the path of the good, and then we personally align ourselves more with those paths, and that's a way.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yes. I mean, you can think of it at a fairly elementary level if you just think of, you know, you're learning mathematics, right? Things are eternally true after all. And everybody learning mathematics is learning the same thing, right? Everybody learns 2 + 2 = 4. Everybody learns the Pythagorean theorem. But one of the wonderful things about mathematics, which has revealed itself more since Dante's time, is that it's infinitely bottomless, right? You can keep on learning mathematics and never get to the end of it. So there's a sense in which we're all learning the same thing, but what we're learning is so vast that there's also this differentiation. You know, it's like you're going to learn the mathematics of Mozart symphonies, and I'm going to learn the mathematics of Bach cantatas, right? Both of which are very mathematical, right? But in a different way. And it's all the same mathematics, and it's all infinitely beautiful. But some of us are going to be more Mozartian, and some of us are going to be more Bachian, right? And maybe even some Beethovens.
But that's a great point to avoid this, especially I felt like a bit younger, that there's a need of feeling to have a sense of your own identity. And if you just absorb all the ancient wisdom and just go with that, it's almost like you don't have your own independent thinking. So that was a slight resistance earlier, but this is kind of changing. But what you're saying there is perfect in the sense of just you can choose, you can navigate this endless sea of wisdom and beauty and form your own, like your own territory
It's the same sun, it's the same light, but we all come at it from different angles. And part of it, and this is going to be very important for Dante, is that, you know, we are differentiated by our bodies, right? In Thomas Aquinas, the body is the principle of differentiation between one being and another. This is why every angel is its own species, because they can't be differentiated by bodies. So each one is a different form. Whereas for the human form, it's the soul, right? So what differentiates us from one soul to the other is the body, with its history, its wounds, right? And that may be something that Dante should say a little bit more about. I mean, he affirms the resurrection of the body, of course, but in Paradiso, you know, these folks don't have their bodies yet. But, you know, the resurrection of the body will give us the body that came from our mothers. Right, the body that came from our mother's womb, and Christ himself has the body that came from the Virgin. And there may be more to say about that the Paradiso doesn't quite give us.
Yeah. It's also, when you say this, I'm suddenly thinking in some sense, or just the better you get to know the Divine Comedy, in some, you can feel that you're getting also closer to Dante's, like not the, well, sort of like the soul of Dante, but you feel that you're getting closer to what he is trying to say by just understanding him better. It's just one example of kind of you're getting closer to things by on this, like going deeper. And then you also see how he is navigating and choosing from the whole like 2,500 years before him. And then he is making his own little kind of imprint or selection to this all. Okay, so I thought maybe just like last 5-10 minutes looking a bit at the sun, since you mentioned already now the sun as that maybe a place you would like to be. So also for listeners, you have, the sphere of the sun is one of the biggest spheres, like 4.5 cantos in Paradiso, and that is where you have all the theologians and also some just virtuous people. You have 24 people in 2 rings, and this is kind of the illuminating part of kind of those who knows how he breathes and how he begets, as he says in the beginning. And that's really the like this enormous tribute to wisdom, as Dante is putting there. And just going to read the beginning. It's so beautiful, the beginning. It's a little, 4 terses there. But I always have the sense when Dante gets here to Canto 10 in Paradiso, he really sees this is the last part of the whole comedy that he spent 12 years of writing. There's a sense in it, like now he's going to start on the real, deepest, most glowing
really
stuff.
Real.
Yes, and we're just out of this the shadow of the earth as well, because that goes over the first 3 spheres. So he says that he opens with, looking upon his son with all that love, which each of them breathes forth eternally, that uncreated, ineffable first one, has fashioned all that moves in mind and space in such sublime proportions that no one can see it and not feel his presence there. Look up now, reader, with me to the spheres. Look straight to that point of the lofty wheels where the one motion and the other cross, and there begin to revel in the work of that great artist who so loves his art, his gaze is fixed on it perpetually.
Mm.
That is the preamble of that one. He still gives me the chills to just read it. One thing that when you had, so you mentioned mind and space as well.
Yeah, there we are. Yeah.
What I love about this is, and that struck me the first time, that he's pointing to the mirroring of the world outside and how we perceive it in our minds. And they are, I mean, there are 2 things, but they are, it's just like that he's pointing to this reflection, which is so powerful, I think.
Yeah. And of course, the initial image is Trinitarian, right? It's the looking on his son with the love which the one breathes to the other. So that's the Father looking at his son through the Holy Spirit, who is the love that is breathed forth from the Father and the Son. Or this is the West where the Spirit comes from the Father and the Son.
Filioque debate comes.
Right? And the Holy Spirit is the love that unites Father and the Son and is breathed forth from both of them. And that's the source of creation also, right? Yeah. Because it's the triune God who's the creator. So that last bit is how the master looks, fixes his gaze on his art.
Exactly.
And the art is the son, who is the wisdom and the word of God through whom he made all things. So right, Christ, Christ is the wisdom and word and art of God through which all of this beauty comes. And that's what wisdom is about. Right, because wisdom is about seeing how God, the triune God, creates all things in the image of his beauty. Mm. And that's, you know, you need 24 people at least to do that, right?
I hadn't connected it before, like the Trinity in the beginning as creation, and then you get the artist right after.
Right.
And the gaze is fixed on it. Yeah.
It's related to the fact that in the great Trinitarian theologies of the 4th century, you have, you know, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and that's the Logos, that's Christ. But the parallel passage that they also discussed all the time was Proverbs 8, where the Lord creates the world through wisdom, right? So by wisdom, God creates heaven and earth. And the church fathers read that and said, yeah, that's saying the same thing as in the beginning was the Word and all things came into being through the Word. So Christ is Word, Christ is wisdom, and yet Christ is the divine art by which the divine artist makes all things. And that's what wisdom contemplates, human wisdom contemplates. And that's what those 24 theologians are all doing, is they're contemplating that wisdom by which God made the world.
So And there's so much to say about these things. The knowledge and the love. So he talks about the cherubim and the seraphim. Those are the two highest levels of the angelical beings, right. And they represent love and knowledge, wisdom.
Right.
Cherubim as streams of knowledge. So there's a play between love and knowledge as the two deepest, strongest forces of reality, of existence, everything. You had somewhere in the essay you wrote something about the love. No, first see, then love, because these two, the inner circle is the Franciscans, and the inner circle is knowledge, is the Dominicans, and the outer one is love. And it's important because Dante is suggesting that knowledge comes first, then comes love, grows out of knowledge.
Yes.
They are also going back and forth like a twin garland of flowers. They have this kind of unity between those two schools.
Because one comes first, but they're absolutely inseparable. Yeah.
Exactly. So, and then in those two rings, you have them, for the most part, Dominicans and Franciscans. So, but it's a very interesting mix of 24 people. So sometimes I see this as Dante's idea of a university, of a seminar, kind of. These are the, you should start with these 24 thinkers or have knowledge of them. Mm-hmm. Just overall, it's like out of 24, you just have two from the Old Testament, old biblical stories. You have eight from like the late Roman classical times, and then you have 14 from his recent time. Many of them kind of mystics as well. So like from the monasticism and this, like the 11 and 1200s. So they are the kind of the biggest.
Mm-hmm, right.
But there's a really fascinating mix of thinkers, and also some more Eastern. You have Christosom is there, and Dionysius is there, the Areopagite. What do you make of it?
I don't know if there's a simple sort of architectonic explanation of each item in the 24. I think of it's like windows in a cathedral, right? You're walking down the nave and you've got 12 windows on each side, right? And they're looking at each other, but I don't see a simple sort of formula for who's what, other than the basic structure that you've got the Dominicans with Thomas Aquinas, who are emphasizing the intellectual aspect, because you have to see in order to know what you love. And then there's St. Bonaventure and the Franciscans, who are more about love than about seeing. But of course, they need each other, and there's this wonderful courtesy of them, right? So Thomas Aquinas praises St. Francis and then condemns the corruption of his own Dominican order. And Bonaventure, the Franciscan, praises St. Dominic, the founder of Thomas's order, and then condemns the corruption of the Franciscan. So there's this deep courtesy between love and knowledge, or intellect and will. And then they're inseparable, and they're also an image, the 24 elders in the book of Revelation in chapter 5, right? The 24 elders are probably the 12 sons of Jacob and the 12 apostles, right? So this is not as high up as that, but it's something like that. It images that. Yeah.
You have it in the Garden of Eden. You get the 24, like representing the books of the Old Testament. Then you have that procession also with the 24 number.
But, at the top of purgatory. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So 24 is a big number. And yet we're only partway up to heaven, right? The sphere of the sun, fascinatingly, is not at the highest point of heaven, right? It's the point where there's no more shadow of earth, because you can't have shadows in the sun, right? And we know that, what Venus and Mercury and the moon all get shadowed by the earth, or can be eclipsed by the earth. The sun cannot be eclipsed by the earth. But above that, it's fascinating. Above the theologians is the just rulers, right? The rulers are actually higher up than the theologians. And then the highest are the monastics, Saint Benedict, right? So the theologians, they're just professors and such, right? And they're writers. They're writers. People like you and me, we write books, right? We do podcasts, right? We need to know our place. We're not as high up as the rulers in the spiritual order.
But it's very interesting, like Saint Aquinas and Saint Bonaventure, they were lecturers at Sorbonne, like the University of Paris. They weren't kind of recluse monks. They were right in the middle of education, like an rational education. It's very, very rational. It's like Richard of St. Victor is there. He's very rational in his approach to theology. So,
I think the way to think about it is their home is the university, whereas two spheres higher, you're up in the sphere of Saturn, which is the sphere of contemplation, but that's the monastery, right? So in fact, to be in the university is to be involved in what medieval folks would call the active life. The teacher is living the active life, not the contemplative life, because, you know, we might rather be reading good books, but instead we're having to talk to students, right? And that's a work of charity and a work of love, but it's not the highest work, which is the work of contemplation. Yeah. So these are teachers, right? They're busy preparing lectures.
Such a great point. This is the founding of universities in Bologna, Paris. I guess also Oxford comes a bit later, but
most of these folks were lecturers in university.
It's also interesting with the sphere of Saturn with the monastics, that it's one of the shortest ones. It's one and a half kantos. And you have the big ladder. It's almost like a catapult. You get there, you just meet it. It's such an intense spiritual glow in it, and then you just you're up into the fixed stars.
Because if you're with Benedict, why are you paying attention to Benedict? Benedict isn't paying attention to Benedict. Benedict is looking upward. You ought to look where he's looking. So it launches you right straight into the sphere of the fixed stars, and then the next thing is the vision of Christ and Mary.
Is fantastic. I'm just watching the time here. I would like to go on for another hour about the sun, but I think we're going to wrap it up here as a first talk and just like an introduction for people also to Paradiso. It's such a marvel of a book, but it takes some time and you need some guidance. I don't know if you have any final thoughts about just Paradise
to touch on something we said before, this is a book to live with for a long time, to come back to over and over again. And you do end up being different when you come back to it 5 years later or 10 years later. I have the great privilege of teaching it regularly. You learn from it and it changes you. It's meant to do that. And it by and large succeeds, I think.
Yeah, I would say the same. I'm still in the process of just learning even more. So
we're still in the journey, right? We're not in the circles yet. Yeah. We're in the journey, right? Yeah. Our movement is toward an end that we have not arrived at yet.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah. And it goes, maybe a final quote from Dante, which he takes from the medieval cosmology, that like, what is the goal of the intellect? And then that is to increase your understanding of the divine essence. The intellectual goal.
Beatific vision, yes.
Exactly.
We're not there yet.
But I mean, the process is the joy of it, isn't it? So
right. And Dante gives you the sense of why it's a joy. And then the Paradiso really does grow on you, the sense of delight, I think. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Okay, so thanks so much, everybody, and see you again in another episode. And bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.